The same religion that's capable of hideous acts of destruction can also be capable of moments of healing, of restoration, and of hope.
But educate a girl, and you educate her entire family.
There is a son within every person.
When that anger sets in, write it. Write the letters, but don't send them. You never want to leave concrete proof of insanity.
Knowing our panelists and our participants and our sponsors well, I know that we don't take ourselves too seriously, but we may be a little more serious than usual this morning because our subject is very serious. The subject of genocide and who speaks for humanity is a critical one, perhaps the most critical one on the planet at this particular time. And that was illustrated for me pretty remarkably by a cartoon that appeared in the Rocky Mountain News. I didn't want to do a whole projector thing, and obviously many of you can't see this, but you can get the idea of the cartoon. It's right before Halloween, and it's a graveyard, and the tombstones read this way: "The Holocaust, 1938 to 1945, never again." Ukraine, 1932 to 1933, never again. Nanking, 1937 to 1938, never again. Armenia, 1915 to 1918, never again. Bosnia, 1992 to 1995, never again. You get the idea. The last and most recent tombstone reads Darfur, 2003, and there is a shovel by the tombstone. I think this represents the challenge that we have and the challenge that I see as a historian. Darfur is not the first of its kind. Hopefully, prayerfully, it may be the last of its kind. That may be resting a good deal on what we and others like us decide to do, as well as to say. I have the honor of introducing Dr. Robert Orr to you, our keynote speaker. Dr. Orr is Assistant Secretary General for Policy Coordination and Strategic Planning in the Executive Office of the Secretary General of the United Nations. Dr. Orr came to the United States, or the United Nations, from Harvard University, where he served as the Executive Director of the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at the Kennedy School of Government. Prior to this, he also served as director of the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington, D.C. From 1996 to 2001, Dr. Orr served in senior posts in the government of the United States, including deputy to the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations and director of the U.S. UN Washington office, where he was instrumental in securing an agreement to have the United States to pay its arrears to the United Nations. If he hadn't done anything else, that would get him a round of applause. Dr. Orr has published extensively on post-conflict reconstruction, the United Nations, peacekeeping, and democracy promotion. His publications include Winning the Peace, an American Strategy for Post-Conflict Reconstruction, and Keeping the Peace, Multidimensional UN Operations in Cambodia and El Salvador. He received his PhD and his MPA in International Relations from the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University, and his bachelor's degree from the University of California, Los Angeles. Dr. Robert Orr.
thank you so much for both that generous introduction and for all these smiling faces today. I like the way that you set this up to note that we are here for a very somber topic this morning. I must say I must have been on the East Coast for too long because I kept thinking, you know, on a subject like genocide and a beautiful morning in Santa Barbara, how many people would actually turn up to hear about genocide? We now have a wonderful answer. I think about a cartoon, and this shows I've just been in New York too long now, from The New Yorker, that shows two New Yorkers walking down the street, and one says to the other, "Hey, you want to grab a drink after the panel on genocide?" And it strikes me that we have a real hard time incorporating a subject like genocide into our normal daily lives. It's not a normal thing. So you are free to go get a drink after or whatever else you want to do, but to think about how do we incorporate something so terrible into our normal lives is something that I hope all of us will do today. I'd like to thank the organizers for this opportunity to speak with you and all of you for coming. In the aftermath of World War II, Raphael Lemkin coined the term genocide. Lemkin was a lawyer and a Holocaust survivor, and he wanted to find a way to describe the policies that had been used to exterminate Jews and others throughout Europe, and he wanted to define it in order to prevent this from happening again. The result of his efforts in 1948 was the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. And this was adopted by the United Nations, and it went into force 3 years later. This convention defined genocide as acts committed with intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a national ethnic, racial, or religious group. And it made genocide a punishable crime under international law. The United Nations itself was also created from the ashes of World War II and the atrocities of the Holocaust in order to prevent the extraordinary human suffering witnessed during that time. From the beginning, the UN has spoken to the ideals of people around the world for a better and more secure future. It was, as former President Clinton recently called the UN, the institutionalization of hope, based on three ideals: the maintenance of peace and security, promotion of economic development, and the protection of human rights. As envisioned from the beginning of the organization, governments could take action under the UN Charter to prevent genocide. The second Secretary General of the UN, Dag Hammarskjöld, once said, "The UN was not created to get us all to heaven. It was to prevent us from going to hell." Genocide is the ultimate hell. So while I think there are many who have responsibility in preventing genocide, I want to put us, collectively and through the UN, on the hook today for who will speak for humanity. The UN, however, has not always lived up to its promise, sometimes succumbing to divisive international politics, the lack of collective political will to confront evil, and a callous tendency to prefer the sovereign rights of nations over the rights of vulnerable individuals in those nations. The cartoon that was just mentioned is a perfect example of that. In the case of the UN that I'm personally familiar with and specific situations I've worked on, Cambodia. Yes, the UN was mostly responsible for bringing peace to that country, but not until over 1 million people had lost their lives in a genocide. In Rwanda in 1994, in Bosnia, these are all personal experiences for those of us who were involved in policy making at the time. In short, history demonstrates that the UN faces a fundamental dilemma. On one hand, it represents the highest ideals of humanity and the institutionalization of hope, but at the same time, its high ambitions have often contrasted sharply with what national governments have been able to agree on and deliver. While the UN may be imperfect, it is also indispensable. As the only universal body representing and bringing together every country and region in the world, the UN enjoys a unique legitimacy. And the UN is not only just a legitimizing organization, it is increasingly an operational organization. It was set up as a conference servicing organization, essentially, to bring nations together to talk. Now, the UN is the preeminent provider of peacekeeping in the world. Over 93,000 peacekeepers now in the world, a higher number of troops deployed around the world than any country except the United States. The UN is the second highest provider of troops around the world. Obviously, these are national troops, but under a UN flag and UN command, greater than any entity outside the United States. The UN is also the preeminent provider of humanitarian assistance. Just in the recent years, over $40 million a year average to 40 countries, and that is going up steeply every year now. The UN is also the preeminent provider of support to democratic elections, not just monitors, but actually organizing elections, supporting administrative tribunals that set up independent elections. And the UN has recently become the provider of the framework of the Millennium Development Goals for advancing a number of key goals, including the halving of poverty in the world by the year 2015. So if the UN is a preeminent provider in these key areas that even a decade ago, one could not have said any of these things about the United Nations. So huge progress in the last decade. What about preventing genocide? Is the UN's role to be limited to providing the normative and legal framework for combating genocide as defined in the Genocide Convention? Or can the UN become the preeminent service provider in this area, as it has in these other areas that I mentioned? First, let's look at some of the limitations. The UN is not a world government. We don't have our own military. We can't just decide to intervene. We depend upon the collective will of the member states of the United Nations. But what can we do so that we don't just fall back and say, it's just those guys on the Security Council that can't agree, we're stuck? The Secretary General of the United Nations can use the bully pulpit, and in this case, that of Darfur, that we'll be discussing today in some depth. The Secretary General has used his voice on every occasion to raise the hue and cry about the situation in Darfur. And in September 2005, at the World Summit convened in New York, the largest gathering ever of heads of state in the world, over 170 together in one place, our security people's ultimate nightmare, having all those people in one place at one time. This largest ever group of heads of state passed what was called a responsibility to protect, a new principle approved by consensus of all the leaders of the world, that every government has the responsibility to protect its populations from genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing, and crimes against humanity. And that's obviously been on the books under the Genocide Convention. But here's the new twist. But when those countries are unable to do so, those governments are unable to do so, or unwilling to do so, the community of nations must be prepared to take collective action through the Security Council of the United Nations. Now, collective action does not necessarily mean military intervention. In fact, the responsibility to protect that was passed by the General Assembly of the UN specifically names diplomatic activity, humanitarian activity, and says, and other means can be used, including military means under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter. So there are a whole spectrum of things that can be done to prevent genocide legitimately by the international community, essentially in place of a sovereign government's inability to provide those protections. This is a historic agreement. But now we face the question how to operationalize this historic agreement. I want to look at three different types of vehicles that we currently have at our disposal and how we might improve and enhance those to really operationalize our capacity to prevent genocide. First, the Office of the Special Advisor of the Prevention of Genocide. Bet you didn't know any such thing exists. The gentleman who the Secretary General named to this, Juan Mendez, is an individual of extraordinary capability, himself a survivor of torture and crimes in his home country of Chile. So he brings a special personal commitment to this this work. His job, with the tiny little staff he has, is to act as an early warning mechanism on genocide, so that we can't say, as many did in Rwanda, we just didn't know it was coming. We didn't see it. We didn't know. Having this office and someone dedicated to going out and finding situations that could be leading in this direction and then raising that to the Security Council, the General Assembly, and other bodies, you will, I think, not be surprised to learn he has been extraordinarily active on Darfur, and much of the information that is channeled, not just publicly, but privately, to all of the governments and bodies around the world that need to act on this, comes from his tiny little office. What can we do to strengthen that office of the Special Advisor on the Prevention of Genocide? Second, we have a new Human Rights Council to replace the old Human Rights Commission. So far, the headlines have not been good coming out of Geneva, that the new body is acting a bit like the old body, with a very proud history of creating norms of human rights protection, but a very poor recent history of politicizing the question of protecting human rights. What can we do to make sure that this Human Rights Council lives up to its potential? This council, unlike the commission, has the ability to meet year-round. Genocides don't just happen during one or two sessions of the former commission a year. It can happen anytime. So this council has the ability to meet at any part of the year at the drop of a hat. Takes one excuse away from governments to say, well, we have to wait until June to be able to consider this question of what's happening in Darfur. Second, the new council is charged with creating a universal peer review mechanism for human rights. This means every single country of the UN, 192 member states, have to have their human rights record examined. Believe it or not, that was not the case previously. But we have yet to see what this mechanism will look like. The council also is considering the so-called special procedures that are used to confront various types of human rights violations. It really matters what they decide to do with these special procedures. Dick Falk, who has been so involved with human rights over the years and international machinery, I hope will say a little bit about this. I didn't warn him I was going to put him on the spot on that. The third set of mechanisms that we have, but we have to improve and make sure deliver, are the judicial or juridical bodies of the International Criminal Court, the ad hoc war crimes tribunals, and the new hybrid national-international courts. Within the last 10 years, we've seen real progress in this area. The International Criminal Court was a dream a decade ago. It is now a body that is already making a difference, but has a long way to go. And I say it's already making a difference when we look at a country like Darfur. The Security Council has referred the case of Darfur to the ICC, and as we sit here this morning, investigators are collecting cases of potential genocide war crimes in Sudan. That puts a certain kind of pressure on everyone involved. Secondly, the tribunals for Rwanda and Yugoslavia have tried the first genocide cases against top officials in those countries. And thirdly, we have a new breed of hybrid national-international courts in Sierra Leone and Cambodia, two countries with particularly devastating pasts, trying to come to grips with that. So we have these mechanisms. We have to make sure that, in fact, they work. Some have said that pursuing justice may undermine peace. Most recently, we've heard this in the case of Uganda, and whether or not the ICC, the International Criminal Court, should really pursue the question of war crimes in northern Uganda. 30 years of really despicable things have happened in Uganda. Very few people know about it. So now there's been a peace agreement, and many say, don't get involved with the pursuit of justice. It will only get in the way of the pursuit of keeping the peace. I think this is a short-sighted way to approach the issue. There is a balancing act, and I can testify to you there's a balancing act of how to deal with governments that are abusing their populations when you're trying to bring those same individuals to the table for peace talks. But in the long run, we will all lose if we do not let our mechanisms to ensure that impunity is not enjoyed by those people. We must make sure these instruments function as they can. I want to turn to Darfur now specifically, because we've witnessed progress and we now have mechanisms we didn't have before. But can we actually prevent genocide? Here will be the test, the singular biggest test right now. The situation on the ground is extremely stark. Since 2003, more than 200,000 people have been killed. Over 2.5 million have been displaced from their homes. Anyone who has been to the camps inside and outside of Darfur can testify that these 2.5 million people are not living well. They're not living in dignity. They're not living in security. And just as a reminder, 6 days ago, militias backed by the government in Sudan undertook a series of attacks in West Darfur against 8 different communities, leaving scores of dead, including 27 children under the age of 12. 6 days ago. Barely makes a headline, or doesn't make a headline anywhere, barely makes a squib in most papers. We have seen last May the signing of a Darfur peace agreement, an important agreement, if not a perfect one, and a possible roadmap for ending the violence, but not all the parties have signed on to it. The Security Council recently adopted a resolution calling for sending UN peacekeeping troops into Darfur. This has been rejected by the Sudanese government, and under the rules of Chapter 6 of the UN Charter, unlike Chapter 7, in which the Security Council can necessitate going in whether or not the government agrees, under Chapter 6, which is what this resolution is, we have to get permission from the government. So how can we raise the pressure on both the authorities in Sudan and on all the outside supporters to ensure that the UN gets that invitation in? This is the question now. We need smart pressure. We need targeted pressure. We don't need brash statements from various governments that don't intend to follow through on them. We need a campaign to get the UN into Darfur. What that campaign looks like, I'll best leave to others, because as a sitting UN official, I don't think it's for me to describe what kind of an external campaign should look like. But I can say from the inside, we need that campaign, and that campaign has to focus on our member governments. On the inside, we get it. We're raring to go. We've done all the planning. We are ready to go. We need the green light. We have to change the calculation of the government and of all the external parties. How do we do that? The responsibility to protect, I think, must not just be invoked. We have to walk the walk, not talk the talk. We have to support the Office of the Special Advisor on the Prevention of Genocide. And we have to raise the pressure on the Human Rights Council. The Secretary General opened the last session of the Human Rights Council with a statement directly calling on the members of the Human Rights Council to adopt a resolution on Darfur specifically. They have not yet done so. They meet again in just a few days. Pressure to make sure that all the governments sitting on the council see the need to pass a specific resolution on Darfur. And we need to support the work of the International Criminal Court in Sudan. Just because the court exists and just because they're doing the investigation doesn't mean that political pressures won't be brought to bear on them and on all the governments that might be asked to see those findings. So we have to provide the support so that the ICC can see its mission through in this case. I'd like to just conclude by speaking a bit more generally for a moment about how to prevent genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity. We have many challenges ahead, there is no doubt, but nothing is inevitable. We have made some real progress. We have learned, partially, but we have learned from some of the previous cases. Genocide is indeed preventable, to go to the title of today's session. 60 years ago, we didn't even have a name for this evil. Now we have a name, we have a normative framework, we have laws, we have tools, and we have an increasing body of knowledge about how to use those tools. The question is now, will we use them? Do we have the collective will to use them? Let us, in this room today, work together to make sure that those tools are used. Santa Barbara may feel as far from Darfur as any place on Earth. It is just about physically as far as any place on Earth, but metaphorically, it is perhaps the farthest place on Earth from Darfur. The fact that so many of you have come out today to talk about genocide and Darfur is extremely encouraging. Please let your representatives know how you feel. You don't need to start with Congresswoman Capps. I spoke with her this morning. She is way ahead of you on this already. So when I say speak with your representatives, I mean that metaphorically. Don't go beat up on her. She gets it. But do make sure that all your representatives at all levels hear your voices, that you care about this little place halfway across the globe called Darfur. Support UN efforts. We are working this actively, daily, intensely. But it is a challenge. We need that political support. Support all the NGOs, some of which are even based in this town, that have people on the ground in Darfur. These are the ultimate front lines. The most vulnerable people beyond the citizens of Darfur are not our soldiers. They're not even our policemen. They're not the policemen of the AU or the soldiers of the African Union. They are the humanitarian workers. The head of our humanitarian operations reported to me just 2 days ago that we are now losing an average of 10 to 15 vehicles per week in carjackings and with serious consequences for our staff. And this is happening to NGOs even more than it's happening to us in the UN. This is all happening as we speak. So support those NGOs, support the UN, support the African Union and everything that it is doing to stop the situation. Today's topic was who speaks for humanity? One of my favorite sayings over the years is by a German pastor, Martin Niemöller, citizen who reflected on the challenges that he saw in Germany during his life and his brush with genocide in that country 60 years ago. First, they came for the communists, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a communist. Then they came for the Jews. I didn't speak up because I was not a Jew. Then they came for the Catholics, and I didn't speak up because I was a Protestant. Then they came for me. And by that time, there was no one left to speak for me. So the question posed today, who speaks for humanity? The answer is clear. We do. We must. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Orr. We have a very distinguished panel to talk with us this morning and add their perspectives, their information, their expertise to that of Dr. Orr. I'm going to be introducing them in a minute, but first I'd like to ask if anyone has gotten those cards we spoke about a little while ago. No cards? Is there anyone who has cards that are supposed to be out there? Cards? Cards? We do have some cards back there. Okay, the intent here, and I'm sure we'll get these going in a minute, is to hand these cards out to you. And if you have questions that you would like to pose to our keynote speaker or the other members of the panel, that is more than welcome. We're going to try and select from those and get those questions to the panelists after they conclude their opening remarks. So we'll try and get going on that immediately. Let me introduce the panelists to you. And at the conclusion of these introductions, they'll be speaking to you, giving their opening remarks, and talking to you again from their expertise and background. Immediately to the left of Dr. Orr is Professor Richard Falk, who is Professor Emeritus of International Law and Practice at Princeton University and Visiting Distinguished Professor of Global Studies here at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He also serves as the chairman of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation and is a recipient of the UNESCO Peace Education Prize. He has provided expert testimony in many high-profile cases, legislative and administrative hearings. He is the author and co-author or editor of more than 40 books on international law and the law of war. His most recent work is entitled The Declining World Order, which is published this year. Next is Dr. Manu Eskandari. Dr. Eskandari was educated at the French Lycée of Vienna and the French Lycée of Tehran. He received his baccalaureate in philosophy and French literature in Vienna in 1975 and went on to study political science and international law at the University of Vienna. In 1984, he received his PhD from UCSB. And he came to City College in 1992 as a full-time faculty member. He has brought to our campus the Phi Theta Kappa organization, the International Honor Society for two-year colleges, and in 1997 he launched City College's Washington, D.C. program. He has also been instrumental. I was going to call him the founding father, but he didn't want to have that title, so I will just say instrumental. Very instrumental in founding City College's new Middle Eastern Studies program, which is one of our newest features on campus. Marie Clark Brill is acting co-executive director and director for public education and mobilization of Africa Action. Africa Action is the oldest organization in the United States working for justice and peace in Africa. Black and white civil rights leaders who recognize the connection between the civil rights movement and the liberation movements in southern Africa started Africa Action in 1953 as the American Committee on Africa. Marie was previously a director of Quest for Peace at the Quixote Center, where she directed grassroots development work in Nicaragua and domestic and international advocacy work on economic justice. She was educated at Occidental College in Los Angeles. She has lived in developing countries for 12 years. So these are our panelists. Again, each of them are going to speak to you from their own expertise and perspective. And hopefully then, how are we doing on the cards? The cards out there yet? Is that a no?
Yes.
That's a yes. Good. All right.
It's a great pleasure to participate once again in this annual event, and it's a particular pleasure today to be to have the opportunity and challenge to comment on Robert Orr's presentation. There's nothing that makes an aging professor more proud than to bask in the reflected glory of former students. And I feel that this is a very good occasion for that kind of self-indulgence on my part. And I must say that Bob Orr has lost none of the serene eloquence that I remember from his student days when He was similarly gifted in articulating complex issues in a very compelling way. Having said that, let me approach this issue from a slightly different point of view, well, maybe a complementary point of view. Robert Orr, I think, powerfully spoke about the positive role that the UN can and must play in relation to genocide. But in my view, to take the UN seriously, one also has to look at its problematic side and why it has been so difficult for it to respond. After all, it's been 3 years since these events in Darfur have come to world attention. The UN, we have to understand, is no better or worse than its main members. And I don't think it will offend the League of Women Voters to say that the United States is its most important member and hasn't really contributed in a very constructive way in recent years. And I think we need to remember that not only in the context of genocide, but the recent war in Lebanon, where for 34 days the UN Security Council couldn't summon the consensus needed to call for a ceasefire in the face of one of the more blatant recent violations of the UN Charter prohibiting the use of aggressive force in situations other than self-defense. So I think I want to make three provocative remarks, partly to agitate all of us on this beautiful day. And of course, it's not so impressive that people come on a beautiful day in Santa Barbara, because every day is beautiful. You understand, in New York, you have to celebrate when there are not so many clouds in the sky. But let me say three things. And as I say, they're overstatements made for provocative, but I think usefully provocative purposes. The first is to say the UN and the world will not be able to prevent genocide if its locus is in Africa. It may do better if its locus is in Asia, and it will certainly do better if its locus is in Europe. Second comment, that recent British public opinion survey concluded, and this may offend the League of Women Voters, George W. Bush is a more dangerous presence for the rest of the world than either Kim Il-Jong or Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. And yet the UN is dependent on its leading member if it is to take important initiatives. And it's true that the U.S. government has, on a rhetorical level, played a fairly constructive role with respect to Darfur, and more generally with respect to genocidal conduct. But it also is true that it's severely discredited as a source of moral and political influence at this stage of history. And not only is it discredited, but its capabilities are tragically diverted to the implementation of disaster in Iraq. And so the UN is badly disabled by this this reality of the UN not being able to have the kind of leadership that the United States had provided the organization in the immediate period after World War II. I think one has to recognize that part of the challenge facing us as Americans is how do we get a government that lives up to the ideals of the UN? Because the UN cannot function effectively or as effectively as the world requires without the constructive participation of the U.S., not only in relation to specific issues, but in relation to world order more generally. Because, as I say, its credibility is so undermined by what it's doing in Iraq and what it's done elsewhere in the Middle East and, to some extent, what it's doing in Afghanistan, that it is not possible for the UN to be as effective as necessary under these conditions. So although the UN is the institutionalization of hope, a very uplifting phrase, unless it lives up to its charter, it also risks becoming the institutionalization of despair. Because to the extent that it cannot do, cannot effectively respond to aggressive war, which was its primary mission, was to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war. And if you were living in Lebanon in the summer of 2006, you couldn't feel very encouraged by the response of the UN. And the same is true if we look back at these, especially these African humanitarian catastrophes that have taken place over the course of the last 15 years, essentially since the end of the Cold War. One thing that I think is interesting to in helping us understand this situation that exists in the world is to compare the response to Darfur with the response to Kosovo in 1999, which I think in many respects was a successful, though controversial, example of humanitarian intervention. And the first thing to notice is that the magnitude of the genocidal challenge in Darfur is many times greater than the feared ethnic cleansing in Kosovo. But the second thing to notice is that Kosovo was in Europe and Sudan is in Africa. In both cases, the governments, the responsible governments, were opposed to international intervention on behalf of the threatened populations. But in one case, in the Kosovo case, those objections were overridden. And in the Kosovo case, the United States was deeply committed to protecting the victimized population in Kosovo. And it was prepared to bring to bear its full engagement outside the UN. And part of the Kosovo response was to emphasize the limits of UN capabilities as compared to the formidable capabilities of NATO, the European alliance. And unfortunately, part of what was being demonstrated was that NATO could do what the UN had failed to do in Bosnia just a little while earlier. And this set of circumstances also reflected the fact that in Kosovo, because of NATO and the ending, the global setting, there was a strategic interest that reinforced the humanitarian motivation. The strategic interest was to show, first, that the United States remained engaged in Europe after the Cold War, and second, to demonstrate that NATO could play a useful role despite the collapse of the Soviet Union and the undermining of the original rationale for the alliance. So what do we conclude from this comparison? One thing I think to conclude is that it's very difficult, given the way the world is structured and the way most sovereign states, not only the U.S., act, that unless there's a reinforcing strategic interest on top of the humanitarian motivation, it's very difficult to obtain an effective form of humanitarian intervention in extreme situations. And we should recall the Somalia response after 18 Americans were killed in Mogadishu. The Clinton administration abruptly reversed its commitment to restore political normalcy to Somalia. So that there then was conveyed a sense that unless humanitarian diplomacy carries with it no risk of casualties, it is a politically non-viable undertaking. And part of the failure to respond to Rwanda was a spillover from the experience in Somalia. And again, in the Clinton liberal administration, there was a bureaucratic decree not to use the word genocide, not to use the word genocide because of an anxiety that if you once labeled what was happening in Rwanda as genocide, it would generate tremendous political pressure, which the Clinton administration wanted to avoid. So what I'm really saying is, it isn't enough to wish for a UN response. How does one fashion a political strategy to give a real foundation of hope that where strategic interests are marginal or absent, there will still be an effective response? And I think that's I don't have a good answer to that, because I don't think there is a good answer to that at the moment. And I think we have to try to do what is possible to do. And I, again, despite what I've been saying, I think the message of Bob Orr's discourse is a challenge that as human beings and as citizens of this country, we need to take as seriously as possible. But we can't really respond to that challenge, in my view, unless we take the obstacles seriously too, because that produces, in my view, wishful thinking that leads to a deferred despair, because what you are hoping for doesn't happen, and then you lose faith in the process itself. But if you understand the obstacles and still persist, then you are you have your eyes wide open and still are engaged. You don't need the false hopes in order to be actively engaged on these issues, in my view. And we need to be, as the Italian political theorist Gramsci famously said, we need to be pessimists of the intellect and optimists of the will in order to address such extraordinary challenges as are posed by this sort of genocidal behavior. Thank you very much.
Good morning. This is an extremely tough and cruel joke being perpetrated on me to have to follow on Professor Richard Falk's remarks. I think my presentation could be very short by just saying everything he said and then some. I was debating last night whether I should remain silent on this panel precisely because Richard Falk is here, who is the voice of our conscience. And I guess I'll have a few things to say, and I did not want to be a silent participant after all. Not that I have much to offer or add in addition to this brilliant critique, especially the concluding thought about Gramsci's call to us, that indeed, the numbers and the statistics and the situation that our senses provide us is cause for pessimism, but we must remain optimists, if for nothing else, but to save ourselves. This morning we heard from Dr. Orr that on the question of who speaks for humanity, we speak for humanity. So to keep our own sanity, we have to speak. On a lighter note, first of all, I'd like to welcome Dr. Orr back to Santa Barbara. I had the happy occasion of running into one of his former teachers of mathematics, who reminded me Bob was a good student. And not just Professor Falk, but also your local teachers here still remember you fondly. And to correct poor Senator Kerry in his ill-fated remarks, if you study hard and you do your homework, you might end up at the UN. I tried to study hard, and I was hoping to also have a career as a diplomat at the United Nations. And then circumstances changed, and I came to this beautiful town, which is a kind of Vanity Fair. And this town kept me here, enthralled by the weather and by the beauty that it provides, and so changed my career to teaching. I don't regret it, but in the person of Dr. Orr, you see what is possible at the United Nations, and may his voice and the voices of others like him be stronger so that we are called back to our senses. I was privileged in 1993 to be sent to the United Nations by a local non-governmental organization of which Richard Falk is now the director and David Krieger is the president, the Nuclear Peace Foundation. They honored me by sending me as their representative to the 1993 World Summit on Human Rights in Vienna. And I was able then to again get a perspective on the operations of the United Nations. And when I came back to give my report, I was not very positive and optimistic about what the United Nations can in fact achieve. And the situation in Vienna was emblematic of what was wrong with the organization then, and unfortunately still is wrong with it, and Professor Falk made these remarks to you this morning by pointing to the fact that the United Nations is, in the end, a forum for the governments that have the most power at its core at the Security Council, and generally, even in the General Assembly, is a forum for the governments of the world, most of whom are not representatives of their peoples in the end. In Vienna, it was graphically put when the voice of the peoples of the world was relegated to subterranean caves, whereas the human rights abusers were upstairs being feted. And the NGOs in Vienna reminded loudly the governments of the world who were there that it is they who speak for humanity and not the representatives who are sitting on the floor, who, to my dismay, at a conference on human rights were concerned with two things. One, where is the cocktail party tonight? Two, where did you buy that? Having come with their spouses, they were concerned about where the sales are in Vienna, and they were concerned about the next party. This I was privy to as I was walking on the floor of the United Nations conference and listening to them. Some of them actually showed up on the floor with their shopping bags. So I don't mean to belittle the organization nor belittle the representatives there, who some of them were genuinely trying to make a difference. But this was emblematic in my view of what is wrong with the United Nations as it is presently constituted. The fact that the Dalai Lama was not allowed to speak at the United Nations that year, but had to speak outside the building. He was basically relegated to a parking lot because China objected to the fact that the Dalai Lama should speak at the United Nations. Was emblematic of what was wrong then and is still wrong now. But not everything is gloom, because the United Nations, as we heard today, has made great strides. It is true that it is not capable of addressing problems where the politics are high. But we must not forget that the United Nations, in its medical efforts, in its efforts for rehydration, for instance, and in generally humanitarian efforts, has made a great difference. Its absence would have created a world that is far more gloomy than the one we live in right now. This said, Professor Falk is quite right, and I don't need to remind you of that, that given the three worlds that he drew for us, the images that he drew for us, adding to that the overlay of high politics, the United Nations still to this day would be paralyzed when it comes to taking action. Even though I must add to Professor Falk's remarks that this administration did finally use the word genocide when it came to the question of Darfur. It now remains a question as to when this word genocide, that has been officially used by the administration, will become an impetus for action. To change emphasis just a little bit and to expand on the notion of genocide, we heard this morning a definition given by Dr. Orr on the term genocide, and genocide refers to the willful extermination of a people or a race. If we take this term to mean when through conscious actions great numbers of people are put at risk of death, then the largest notion of genocide would be to take actions that would destroy the globe. I am a consultant, proudly so, of the Nuclear Peace Foundation that I've already mentioned, and the Nuclear Peace Foundation's aim has been to achieve the reduction and then finally the eradication of nuclear weapons in the world. Nuclear weapons are termed omnicidal weapons. We are speaking of genocide when it comes to the eradication of a people. We speak of omnicide when it comes to the eradication of life on Earth. And so we must consider, when we say who speaks for the world and who speaks for humanity, those who speak for the eradication of nuclear weapons, certainly, as individuals who speak for the world because of the urgency that they see to eliminate a class of weapons that by willful action or by accident could in fact eliminate life on Earth. The other element that I would like to include in the term genocide is of course the fact that the world is facing, if not imminent, certainly in the near future, a global climatic catastrophe. And not to depress us, because we are indeed in a beautiful town with beautiful sunrises and sunsets, but the situation of the world due to inaction by governments and action by governments has come to a point where it cannot be denied that if no corrective measures are taken, the world is going to face, by the year 2050, a situation where either, and this is the wording of the report by Sir Nicholas Stern, former chief economist to the World Bank, that by 2050, we either have to find another planet, or half the population of the Earth will have to do without. If this does not constitute genocide, if this does not constitute a proper inclusion into the term genocide, then I don't know what does. I would like to recommend, I wanted to take some time to read the executive summary of the Stern report to the government of England, but I would like to recommend it to your attention without troubling you with further detail at this point. The Stern report by Sir Nicholas Stern points out that we still have time to take corrective measures, but the measures that have to be taken now are drastic. Today, of course, we speak of genocide situations that arise as a result of military operations by governments or by rogue entities around the world. This particular problem of global climate change is coming about not as a result of the operations of governments, military operations of governments, nor as a result of the operations of rogue entities such as the Janjaweed, but rather as a result of policies, in some cases policies by democratic countries such as this, with regard to economics, and as a result of actions by global corporations. And finally, and in the end, since Dr. Orr reminded us who speaks for the world, we do. Our actions, present speaker included, and everyone in this room, and everyone on the globe included. So, we are indeed, given the facts, given the statistics, given what our senses tell us, we are indeed faced with a pessimistic situation, but we must remain optimistic, to quote Professor Falk again. And this report, though gloomy, does give us an out, but we are facing very, very, very serious and dire circumstances that go beyond, and there is no attempt here to belittle, that go beyond the genocide that is happening in one particular country. We are talking about the future of humanity. And these two points, global climate change and the existence and perpetuation of nuclear weapons on the globe, may in fact make the additional issues that we speak about secondary, if not obsolete, if any of those problems actually become reality. Thank you very much.
Good morning, or almost good afternoon. I know you've been sitting a long time, and I have the unenviable position of not only following such an incredibly distinguished panel, but being the last of the panel to speak. And so just to get your energy back up, when I say good morning, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I think each one of the panelists has been so clear, starting with our fearless leader, Dr. Orr, who speaks for humanity must be responded by, we do. But sometimes, I don't know if you are this way as well, I find that when I'm a part of a we, it can be very empowering, but it also can be a wonderful place to hide. And you can be a part of a we sort of quietly, and you can be a part of a we by coming to a panel and listening to all of these speakers and thinking great thoughts and generally being politically in favor of this or that. But it becomes a lot more challenging if the answer is you. Marie, who speaks for humanity, you do. So I'd like to challenge you each to think about that we and ask yourselves, when the question is posed, who speaks for humanity? Can you say, I do? Because I would argue that you speak for humanity, each single individual one of you, a phenomenal 16-year-old activist in training, a spiritual director, a lawyer, a doctor, a student, an academic, you speak for humanity. And so my question is, given that we all relatively seem to agree that this is an incredible challenge facing our world, that the actors that can act are people who are in power in the United Nations, specifically focusing on the role of the United States, what is it exactly that each one of us can do when we walk out of this room that will make a difference in what can feel like an overwhelming and difficult, as Dr. Orr said, far, far away problem and challenge in our world? And that's what I'd like to focus on. And before laying out a bit of an action plan that I'd like to challenge us to think about taking as citizens, I'd like to talk a little bit more deeply about who the players are specifically here. Because when you want to make change in the world, you need to know not only what is it that you want to change, for example, stop the violence, protect the people of Darfur, but also who has the power to make that change? Who are the levers that make the difference in determining whether or not that change happens? And then what are their spheres of influence? And how do we get access to those people and to those levers? And I think one of the things that has come out strongly here is that there is a real focus in terms of how to make change, stop the violence, protect the people, on that first important priority in responding to genocide, and that is civilian protection. Needing an international body of people that can go in and literally protect people. And that is not going to be the only solution. International intervention is not a panacea. It will not solve the problem by itself. Clearly, there needs to be a political process that brings everyone to the table to secure a peace agreement, something that will be lasting, something that will be more inclusive than the Darfur peace agreement has been to date. And clearly, justice needs to be able to happen through the International Criminal Court. But the very first thing that must happen, not to the exclusion of these important other pieces, is civilian protection. We need to protect the people in Darfur. So how do we achieve civilian protection? Africa Action, from the very beginning of our work, more than 2 years ago, almost 3 years ago now, argued that that civilian protection needed to happen from an international force, not only because it was practical, but because of the principle that this is a genocide, which means that there is an international responsibility to protect, and that we cannot, as Dr. Falk challenged us, look at Africa differently than we would look at other parts of the world. African lives are as valuable as other lives around the world. And so it could not be an African solution to an African problem, because genocide is not an African problem. It needs a global solution. And the cartoons that have been mentioned that lay out the plethora of examples of genocide show us that this is not an African problem, so we need an international solution. And our goal was to get what is now called Resolution 1706 to be passed by the Security Council at the United Nations, a resolution authorizing a Chapter 7 international intervention with a mandate to protect civilians. And I can tell you that it can feel discouraging to be an activist on an issue like this. In many cases, because of the challenges that Dr. Falk laid out so perfectly, the challenge of getting people to care about this crisis in Africa, the challenge of the lack of credibility of the United States and the United Nations at that moment. This is a challenging thing. And so when we first started saying that the first step towards getting to that resolution was we needed to have one country call this a genocide, and Africa Action is located in the United States and influences U.S. policy towards Africa, so the United States was our obvious pick, despite our challenges. And a lot of people told us that this was impossible, that the U.S. would not call Darfur a genocide, that it was not a winnable campaign. Look at what happened in Rwanda. It served no value, no purpose, no political strategic opportunity for the United States to call genocide a genocide. But we were not deterred and implemented an action plan that ultimately led to generating tens of thousands of emails and correspondence to Colin Powell, then Secretary of State, pushing him to go to the region, which after a whole nother series of actions and interventions helped to draw us to the point where Colin Powell did call this to be a genocide, and the United States was on record as one of the first countries to name a genocide while it was happening. And everyone said, it's impossible, but we got it done through citizen action, through engagement, through careful diplomacy. And then we thought, well, of course, if you say genocide, of course there's going to be action. I mean, then everybody is going to have to jump to their feet and implement the Genocide Convention. And of course, that has not happened. It's been over 2 years since the United States declared that this is a genocide. So if we harass the United Nations for having a 3-year lag before action, we must harass the United States for calling a genocide as it was happening 2 years ago and still not having actually enabled there to be change. And so we said, okay, well then the next thing we need to do is get the Bush administration to break the subsequent silence, because the United States called it a genocide but then was fairly quiet about it for about a year and a half later. So again, raising political pressure, and now there were all these new groups engaged. Save Darfur coalition of hundreds of different organizations had developed at that point. We had a huge body of organizations to be able to push this action. And indeed, the President Bush was able to break his silence, and we started to hear increasing interest in at least talking about the fact that this is a genocide. And that's when we could really start working on this resolution. And we thought, surely if a resolution passes the UN Security Council saying that we can have an international intervention, it would happen. And everybody told us, well, you're not going to get the resolution anyways, because China will veto and Russia will veto and Qatar will cause such a big chaos that the whole Security Council will fall apart. But it did pass, and it passed in August, and it passed because of the incredible pressure that was leveraged and the diplomatic action that was happening within the United Nations. It passed because of the leadership of Kofi Annan and other very important people in this world, and because of a new interest and conviction on the part of several members of that Security Council. So again, the impossible was able to be achieved as a result of significant pressure. And now we have perhaps our biggest challenge yet, and that is this question of how do we break the deadlock on Darfur, when Sudan so clearly rejects an international intervention under a blue-helmeted force. And how do we handle this as the international community? I mean, the fact is that this is, in a way, setting the very first precedence after the passage of the responsibility to protect language in the United Nations. Do we only have a responsibility to protect when the government goes along with it? Well, clearly not if you look at at those words. So do we allow the Sudanese government, a government that is perpetrating a genocide, to veto that international responsibility to protect? And how do we utilize diplomatic and humanitarian means to turn that around? Because our ideal at Africa Action is that it would be a UN blue-helmeted force. But there's a lot of other opportunities that could happen or could exist that might be able to be a part of breaking through. Some people are talking about, could we collect a force from some of the troops of the Arab League, from other additional African Union members and countries, sort of the African Union troop forces called AMIS, the African Union mission in Sudan. Could it be kind of an AMIS plus? Or could we have a different type of coalition? The question becomes who is in control, who has command, but a coalition that would draw on some of the countries that have been interested in sending troops and drawn perhaps from India or from Pakistan. So our ideal is an international intervention through the United Nations, but there are a lot of places for dialogue that could help to resolve this question of who will protect the people of Darfur. And so when we're looking at that being our goal, and we look at the landscape, our targets need to be the people who have the most leverage to achieve this action and to address what our obstacles are. And we argue at Africa Action that the United States, though it has lost so much credibility in the United Nations, still has the most powerful points of leverage to break the deadlock in Darfur. And I agree with Dr. Orr. We need to be thinking about smart pressure, not just brash statements. And the challenge thus far in the Bush administration's response to the genocide in Darfur is that finally they're on message. But as actually Andrew Natsios mentioned in a meeting we were at not too long ago, it's kind of the opposite of the Teddy Roosevelt small talk, big stick attitude that we have right now with the Bush administration. It's big talk, little stick. And I can tell you right now that's not going to be effective, because you're talking bigger and Sudan is talking bigger and everyone's talking bigger and louder, and it's not breaking that deadlock on Darfur. So what are those little sticks that we can use in a big way as the United States? Where's our leverage? Our leverage is that we have a powerful relationship with the government of Sudan, and especially in light of the war on terror. This is also our greatest challenge as advocates, is that in a way we are fighting over whether or not the Bush administration will prefer its war on terror or the people of Darfur, which means that we need to leverage so much political pressure and loudness that we can really actually be heard in what is, frankly, a lot of people would say, a losing battle. But we had a losing battle in getting genocide to be what the Bush administration called this issue. We had a losing battle in getting Resolution 1706 on the table, much less passed, and those all happened. So we can win this reality. But these sticks that we have are important. The Sudanese government does care about the future relationship of the United States and Sudan. And we're the U.S. to say the future of the Sudanese-U.S. relations is dependent upon an international acceptance of an international force in Darfur that would have a powerful, powerful resonance. If the United States were to talk about new sanctions on Sudan and look at bilateral sanctions and encourage other members of the Security Council to discuss sanctions in a very real way, that would have pressure. The International Criminal Court currently identifies 4 officials in Sudan. If we were to look at what other Sudanese officials were to be on that list, that would be a scary thing, and that would have pressure. If we were to internationalize this pressure and get more of an alliance on the Security Council, specifically use the leverage we have with China and Russia and Qatar, that would help have an impact. And there are carrots as well. These carrots are a lot more difficult when you're talking about providing a carrot to a genocidal regime. But debt cancellation, who is on or off that ICC list, and sanctions are all pieces of those carrots. So if we look at U.S. having access to power, having access to leverage, then the question is, how do we have access to the U.S.? Well, we are the U.S. It's us. It's not just the United States. We are a democracy, and we have the challenge and the obligation to utilize what gives us a unique power to protect people in Darfur. And you've been encouraged already on the panel to talk to your representatives. I would argue that we have such a little timeline. The African Union mandate expires at the end of the year. Violence is escalating at a rate that is reminiscent of the early days of this genocide, and we are coming to a head. So basically, I think we actually have only a couple months to change this situation. So that means we need to be in high gear as activists. So let's go straight to the top. Let's talk about how do we influence the Bush administration, which is making the decisions. Ambassador Bolton is our ambassador at the United Nations, but his boss is President Bush, ultimately. Condoleezza Rice in between. We have a new special envoy on Sudan, Andrew Natsios, who seems to be very genuine in saying that this is a huge priority for you and is for the United States and a huge interest in going on this, but he is not immune to pressure. In fact, he's giving Africa Action a really hard time right now because we crashed his Georgetown server with emails three times over. And let's just say he got the message that we care about this issue and we're concerned. So we have some really specific people that we can influence when we're talking about the genocide in Darfur. And we have an action plan, and it's not just Africa Action, it's a lot of different groups on how to achieve change in the next 90 days. Or less, actually. We're already in it in the next couple months. And so as you're leaving, I hope you'll stop by the Africa Action table. It details specifically in our papers exactly what leverage does the United States have. There's a whole piece on talking points that goes into how we would prove genocidal intent and the five acts of violence. There's a whole variety of different tools that can help you, but there's also that action plan with really specific things that you can be doing, things that are visible, and engaging, things that range from public events. We have people all over the country that have committed to doing public sprints for Darfur because we're in a final sprint in what has felt like a marathon of activism. And these public sprints will be an opportunity for people to literally help us get boots on the ground by strapping on their boots and their running shoes and using the opportunity to do something public and visible to get media attention about this issue. But instead of just getting sponsorships for your sprint where you get sponsored by the minute or by the meter that you're running, we're asking people to write letters to President Bush, to Ambassador Bolton, to Andrew Natsios, so that you're not only doing a sprint that's raising money and raising awareness, but you're raising literally the letters that can make a difference. We have raised, at Africa Action alone, over a quarter million letters and communications with the Bush administration in the last year alone. And as a community of organizations working on this, it's been millions and millions of letters. And we might get so sick of writing letters, but I can tell you we can see after those letters, after public events and engagements, we see policy change. And we cannot allow ourselves to go away from this only with hope and words and a prayer, but we need to go away with action. There's not only the sprints for Darfur. People are creating tarps with red handprints on them that are being sent to our office, and we will be delivering those to Andrew Natsios in the middle of December. We did this in front of the White House not too long ago, and I can't tell you what it was like to see this white tarp on the ground, and we had probably about 1,000 people in front of the White House, and everyone wanted to make their mark as witness that they were there, that they were calling out for a chance. And it got to a point where we were afraid we weren't going to be able to even tell that this was a handprint tarp any longer. It was becoming this sort of sea of red. And it ended up being a beautiful African-looking print, actually, on which we have said, break the deadlock on Darfur. So there are creative ways to take action. There are simple, easy ways to get active through email lists, through letter-writing campaigns. But the key thing is, at the end of the day, 10 years from now, when we are honoring and commemorating the anniversary of the genocide in Darfur, and someone asks you what you did, the question is going to be, will you respond, I gave up a beautiful Saturday morning, and I listened to a phenomenal panel of people, and I thought a lot about it, and it was a real tragedy? Or are you going to respond, I not only went to a panel, I not only thought a lot about this real tragedy, but I took at least one simple and effective action that helped make a difference? And this question has been something on my mind all of the time that I've been active working on this. How do you respond 10 years after a genocide and say what you did or what you didn't do? And about a little over 3 months ago, this question took a new turn for me because I got pregnant and I realized that it's my child that will most likely be the one that's asking me, Murray or Mommy, I guess. Gosh, that sounds weird. What? Help! Parental advice afterwards, please. You know, what did you do about this genocide in Darfur? And I want to be able to respond, I did everything in my power to push my elected government to be a global good neighbor and to stand up for an international responsibility to protect people. Now, I guess I'll have to find a lot easier words for, at that time, a 10-year-old. But I want to be able to say that because the question comes to us when you're reading these reports, and I was reading one last night about how the children's hair in the camps is turning orange because of malnutrition, and about how few men are left in the camps because they're either dead or fighting. And I got to this moment that I get to often at night when I'm reading these reports, where at core I am calling out for someone else bigger and stronger to take over and to be able to respond. In my case, it's usually God. God, protect the people in Darfur. And each time, the response comes from within, whom shall I send? And I have to respond, here I am, send me. So when that question comes to you, and you find yourself calling on a bigger power or your next door neighbor or, you know, the magical creative force in the universe, to respond, listen and see if you're challenged, whom shall I send? And if you respond, because there are places for hope also in this tragedy. And those places of hope I find in the people I work with in Darfur. I think of this woman, Jane, especially in the Amal Center for Torture in Nayala, Darfur. She is a survivor. She's a survivor of rape, of her burned village, of a horrible experience in an internally displaced person camp. But she's now an advocate for human rights, and she is risking her life again and again every day working to be a resource for people. Heroes come out of devastating places. We have a responsibility to uphold those heroes because we have the power to protect them by leveraging the power of our government. So when you feel overwhelmed, think of the heroes. And I'll close with a passage that is from a sermon that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. gave in 1967. It was called, Where Do We Go From Here? Because I think it sums up how to overcome that dreariness. It says, when our days become dreary with low hovering clouds of despair, and when our nights become darker than 1,000 midnights, let us remember that there is a creative force in this universe working to pull down the gigantic mountains of evil, a power that is able to make a way out of no way and transform dark yesterdays into bright tomorrows. Let us realize that the arc of the moral universe is long and it bends towards justice. And if you think that creative force is somewhere outside of yourself, remember that Martin Luther King Jr. was all about liberation theology. That creative force is us. It's you in this room. So let us bend that moral arc of our universe. The complicated politics do not detract from the moral clarity on this issue. We need to protect civilians in Darfur now.